numerous reports, you'll never find a single reference to Connor Fitzgerald.
How do you know all of this, Andy? Asked Lawrence.
Because Jackson called me from St. Petersburg just after Fitzgerald had been arrested.
Do you have a recording of that conversation?
Yes, sir, I do.
God damn it, said Lawrence. Dexter makes J. Edgar Hoover look like a Girl Scout.
If we accept that it was Jackson who was hanged in Russia, we have to assume it was Fitzgerald who flew to Dallas with the intention of buying that rifle so he could carry out his present assignment.
Am I the target this time? Asked Lawrence, quietly.
I don't think so, Mr. President. That's the one thing I think Dexter's being straight about. I still believe the target's Zarymski.
Oh, my God, said Lawrence, slumping into his chair.
But why would an honorable man with a background and reputation as good as Fitzgerald's get involved in a mission like this? It just doesn't add up.
It does, if that honorable man believes that the original order to assassinate Zarymski came from you.
Zarymski was running late when his plane took off from New York to fly him back to Washington, but he was in a good mood. His speech to the United Nations had been well received, and his lunch with the Secretary General had been described in a communique issued by the Secretariat as wide-ranging and productive. During his visit to the Metropolitan Museum that afternoon, not only had Zarymski been able to name the Russian artist who had been given an exhibition in one of the upper galleries, but when he left the museum, he had abandoned his itinerary and, to the consternation of his Secret Service minders, walked down Fifth Avenue to shake hands with Christmas shoppers. Zarymski had fallen an hour behind schedule by the time his plane touched down in Washington, and he had to change into his dinner jacket in the back of the limousine so that he didn't hold up the performance of Swan Lake at the Kennedy Center by more than 15 minutes. After the dancers had taken their final bow, he returned to spend a second night at the Russian embassy. While Zarymski slept, Connor remained awake. He could rarely sleep for more than a few minutes at a time during the build-up to an operation. He had cursed out loud when he'd seen the early evening news coverage of the walkabout on Fifth Avenue. It had reminded him that he should always be prepared for the unexpected. From an apartment on Fifth Avenue, Zarymski would have been an easy target, and the crowd would have been so large and out of control that he could have disappeared within moments. He dismissed New York from his mind. As far as he was concerned, there were still only two serious venues to consider. At the first, there was the problem that he wouldn't have the rifle he felt most at ease with, although with a crowd that large, the getaway would be easier. As for the second, if Romanov could supply a modified Remington 700 by the morning of the banquet and guarantee his getaway, it seemed the obvious choice. Or was it a little too obvious? He began to write out lists of pros and cons for each site. By 2 o'clock the next morning, exhausted, he realized he would have to visit both venues again before he could make his final decision. But even then, he had no intention of letting Romanov know which one he'd chosen.
This ends Disc 7. The 11th Commandment, Disc 8.
Chapter 29. Pug Washer, no one knew his real name, was one of those characters who was an expert on one subject. In his case, it was the Washington Redskins. Pug had worked for the Redskins, man and boy, for 50 years. He had joined the ground staff at the age of 15 when the team was still playing at Griffith Stadium. He had started life as a water boy and had later taken over as the team's masseur, becoming the trusted friend and confidant of generations of Redskins players. Pug had spent the year before his retirement in 1997 working alongside the contractor who was building the new Jack Kent Cook Stadium. His brief was simple: to make sure that the Redskins fans and players had every facility they would expect of the greatest team in the country. At the opening ceremony, the senior architect told the assembled gathering that he would be forever indebted to Pug for the role he had played in the building of the new stadium.
During his closing speech, John Kent Cook, the Redskins' president, announced that Pug had been elected to the team's Hall of Fame, a mark of distinction normally reserved only for the greatest players. Pug told the journalists, "It doesn't get any better than this." Despite his retirement, he never missed a Redskins game, home or away. It took Connor 2 phone calls to track Pug down at his little apartment in Arlington, Virginia. When he explained to the old man that he had been commissioned to write an article for Sports Illustrated on the significance of the new stadium to Skins fans, it was like turning on a tap. "Perhaps you could spare an hour or two to show me around the Big Jack," suggested Connor. Pug's monologue dried up for the first time, and he remained silent until Connor suggested an honorarium of $100. He had already found out that Pug's usual fee for guided tours was $50. They agreed to meet at 11 o'clock the following morning. When Connor arrived at 1 minute to 11, Pug ushered him into the stadium as if he were the owner of the club. For the next 3 hours, he regaled his guest with a complete history of the Redskins and answered every one of Connor's questions, from why the stadium had not been completed in time for the opening ceremony to how the management went about employing temporary labor on the day of a game. Connor learned that the Sony Jumbotrons behind the end zones made up the largest video screen system in the world, and that the front row of seats had been raised 9 feet above the field of play so the fans could see over the television cameras and the bulky players roaming restlessly up and down the sidelines in front of them. Connor had been a Redskins fan for almost 30 years, so he already knew that all the season tickets had been sold out since 1966, and there was currently a waiting list of 50,000. He knew, because he was one of them. He also knew that the Washington Post sold an extra 25,000 copies whenever the Skins won a game. But he didn't know that there were 35 miles of steam-heated pipes under the field of play, that there was parking space for 23,000 vehicles, and that a local band would be playing the national anthems of Russia and the United States before tomorrow's kickoff. Most of the information Pug came up with would be of no practical use to Connor, but he still produced a gem every few minutes. As they strolled around the stadium, Connor could see the tight security checks that the White House advance staff were carrying out for the following day's game. The magnetometers, through which everyone who entered the ground would have to pass and which would detect if they were carrying anything that could be used as a weapon, were already in place. The nearer they got to the owner's box from where the two presidents would be watching the game, the more intense the checks became. Pug was irate when he was stopped by a Secret Service agent guarding the entrance to the executive boxes. He explained forcefully that he was a member of the Redskins Hall of Fame and that he would be among the guests who would meet the two presidents the next day, but the agent still refused to let him in without a security pass. Connor tried to assure the furious Pug that it wasn't that important. As they walked away, Pug muttered under his breath, "Do I look like the sort of person who would want to assassinate the president?" When the two men parted at 2 o'clock, Connor handed his guide $120. The old man had told him more in 3 hours than an entire Secret Service detail would have divulged in a lifetime. He would have given him $200, but that might have aroused Pug's suspicions. Connor checked his watch to find he was running a few minutes late for his appointment with Alexei Romanov at the Russian embassy. As he was driven away from the stadium, he switched on the radio, tuning into C-SPAN, a station he rarely listened to. A commentator was describing the atmosphere on the floor of the house as the members waited for the Russian president to arrive. No one had any idea what Zarymsky was going to say, as the press hadn't been issued with advance copies of the speech and had been advised to check against delivery. 5 minutes before the speech was due to begin, Zarymsky walked out onto the floor of the house, accompanied by his escort committee. "Everyone present," announced the commentator, "has risen from their seats and is applauding the guest from Russia. President Zarymsky is smiling and waving as he makes his way down the aisle through the packed house chamber to the dais, shaking outstretched hands." The commentator went on to describe the applause as warm rather than rapturous. When Zarymsky reached the podium, he carefully placed his papers on the lectern, took out his spectacle case, and put on his glasses. Kremlin watchers immediately knew that the speech would be delivered word for word from a prepared text, and there would be none of the off-the-cuff remarks for which Zarimsky had become notorious during his election campaign. The members of Congress, the Supreme Court, and the diplomatic corps resumed their seats, unaware of the bombshell that was about to be dropped.
"Mr. Speaker, Mr. Vice President, and Mr. Chief Justice," Zarimsky began, "let me begin by thanking you and your countrymen for the kind welcome and generous hospitality I have received on this, my first visit to the United States. Let me assure you that I look forward to returning again and again."
At this point, Titov had written "pause" in the margin, rightly, because there followed a round of applause. Zarimsky then delivered several flattering homilies concerning America's historic achievements, reminding his listeners that three times in the past century their two nations had fought together against a common enemy. He went on to describe the excellent relationship currently enjoyed by our two countries. Tom Lawrence, who was watching the speech with Andy Lloyd on C-SPAN in the Oval Office, began to relax a little. After another few minutes, he even allowed a flicker of a smile to cross his lips. That smile was wiped off his face as Zarimsky delivered the next 71 words of his speech.
"I am the last person on earth who would want our two great nations to become embroiled in another pointless war."
Zarimsky paused. "Especially if we were not on the same side." He looked up and beamed at the assembled gathering, although nobody present appeared to find his comment particularly funny.
"To be sure that such a calamity can never befall us again, it will be necessary for Russia to remain as powerful as the United States on the battlefield if it is to carry the same weight at the conference table."
In the Oval Office, Lawrence watched as the television cameras scanned the sullen faces of the members of both houses and knew that it had taken Zarimsky about 40 seconds to destroy any chance of his arms reduction bill becoming law. The rest of Zarimsky's speech was received in silence. When he stepped down from the podium, there were no outstretched hands, and the applause was distinctly cool. As the white BMW drove up Wisconsin Avenue, Connor switched off the radio. When they reached the gates of the Russian embassy, one of Romanov's henchmen checked them through security. Connor was escorted into the white marble reception area for the second time in 3 days. He could immediately see what Romanov had meant when he said the embassy's internal security was lax. After all, who would want to murder Russia's beloved president in his own embassy? He had remarked with a smile. As they walked down a long corridor, Connor said to Romanov, "You seem to have the run of the building." "So would you have, if you'd paid enough into the ambassador's Swiss bank account to ensure that he never had to return to the motherland again." Romanov continued to treat the embassy as if it were his own home, even unlocking the door to the ambassador's study and letting himself in. As they entered the ornately furnished room, Connor was surprised to see a customized Remington 700 resting on the ambassador's desk. He picked it up and studied it closely. He would have asked Romanov how he'd got his hands on it if he thought there was any chance of being told the truth. Connor gripped the stock and broke the breech. There was a single boat-tailed bullet in the chamber. He raised an eyebrow and glanced at Romanov.
"I assume that from that range you will only need one bullet," said the Russian.
He led Connor to the far corner of the room and drew back a curtain to reveal the ambassador's private lift. They stepped inside, pulled the gate shut, and traveled slowly up to the gallery above the ballroom on the second floor. Connor checked every inch of the gallery several times, then squeezed in behind the vast statue of Lenin. He looked through its cocked arm to check the sight line to the spot from which Zarimsky would deliver his farewell speech, making sure that he would be able to see without being seen. He was thinking how easy it all seemed when Romanov touched him on the arm and ushered him back towards the lift.
"You will have to arrive several hours early and work with the catering staff before the banquet begins," Romanov said.
"Why?"
"We don't want anyone to become suspicious when you disappear just before Zarimsky begins his speech."
Romanov checked his watch. We should go. Zerimsky is due back in a few minutes. Connor nodded, and they walked towards the rear entrance. As he climbed back into the BMW, he said, I'll let you know when I've decided which venue I've chosen. Romanov looked surprised, but said nothing. Connor was driven out through the embassy gates minutes before Zerimsky was due to return from the capital. He switched the radio on in time to catch the early evening news. Senators and congressmen were falling over each other to grab the microphones and assure their constituents that after hearing President Zerimsky's speech, they would not be voting for the nuclear, biological, chemical, and conventional arms reduction bill. In the Oval Office, Tom Lawrence was watching CNN's reporter speaking from the Senate press gallery. No statement has yet come from the White House, he was saying. And the president? And don't hang around waiting for one, Lawrence said angrily as he switched off the television. He turned to his chief of staff. Andy, I'm not even sure I can face sitting next to that man for 4 hours tomorrow afternoon, let alone respond to his farewell speech in the evening. Lloyd didn't comment.
I am looking forward to sitting next to my dear friend Tom and watching him have to squirm in front of an audience of millions, said Zerimsky as his limousine entered the grounds of the Russian embassy. Dmitry Titov remained impassive. I think I shall cheer for the Redskins. It would be an added bonus if Lawrence's team lost, Zerimsky smirked, a fitting prelude to the humiliation I have planned for him in the evening. Make sure you prepare a speech so flattering that it will appear all the more tragic in retrospect. He smiled again. I have ordered the beef to be served cold, and even you will be surprised by what I have in mind for dessert.
Connor spent several hours that evening wondering if he could risk breaking the rule of a lifetime. He phoned Romanov a few minutes before midnight. The Russian seemed delighted that they had both come to the same conclusion.
I'll arrange for a driver to pick you up at 3:30, so you can be at the embassy by 4.
Connor put the phone down. If everything went to plan, the president would be dead by 4.
Wake him up!
But it's 4 o'clock in the morning, said the first secretary. If you value your life, wake him up!
The first secretary threw on a dressing gown, ran out of his bedroom and down the corridor. He knocked on the door. There was no response, so he knocked again. A few moments later, a light appeared under the door.
Come in,
said a sleepy voice. The first secretary turned the handle and entered the ambassador's bedroom.
I'm sorry to disturb you, Your Excellency, but there's a Mr. Stefan Ivanitsky on the line from St. Petersburg. He insists that we wake the president. He says he has an urgent message for him.
I'll take the call in my study, said Petrovsky.
He threw back the blanket, ignoring the groans of his wife, ran downstairs and told the night porter to transfer the call to his study. The phone rang several times before it was eventually picked up by a slightly breathless ambassador.
Petrovsky speaking.
Good morning, Your Excellency, said Ivanitsky. I asked to be put through to the president, not to you.
But it's 4 o'clock in the morning. Can't it wait?
Ambassador, I don't pay you to tell me the time. The next voice I want to hear is the president's. Do I make myself clear?
The ambassador put the receiver down on his desk and walked slowly back up the wide staircase to the first floor, trying to decide which of the two men he was more frightened of. He stood outside the door of the president's suite for some time, but the sight of the first secretary hovering at the top of the stairs stiffened his resolve. He tapped gently on the door, but there was no response. He knocked a little louder and tentatively opened it. In the light from the landing, the ambassador and the first secretary could see Zerimsky stirring in his bed. What they didn't see was the president's hand slipping under the pillow where a pistol was concealed.
Mr. President,
whispered Petrovsky as Zerimsky switched on the light by the side of his bed.
This had better be important, said Zerimsky, unless you want to spend the rest of your days as refrigerator inspectors in Siberia.
We have a call for you from St. Petersburg, said the ambassador almost in a whisper. Hey, Mr. Stefan Ivanitsky, he says it's urgent.
Get out of my room,
said Zerimsky as he picked up the phone by his bed. The two men stepped backwards into the corridor, and the ambassador quietly closed the door.
Stefan, said Zarimsky, why are you calling at this hour? Has Borodin staged a coup in my absence?
No, Mr. President. The Tsar is dead.
Ivanitsky spoke without emotion.
When? Where? How? About an hour ago, at the Winter Palace. The colorless liquid finally got him.
Ivanitsky paused.
The butler has been on my payroll for almost a year.
The president was silent for a few moments before saying,
Good. It couldn't have worked out better for us. I would agree, Mr. President, were it not for the fact that his son is in Washington. There's very little I can do from this end until he returns. That problem may resolve itself this evening, said Zarimsky. Why? Have they fallen into our little trap? Yes, said Zarimsky. By tonight, I shall have disposed of both of them.
Both of them?
Yes, the president replied. I have learned an appropriate new expression since I've been over here, killing two birds with one stone. After all, how many times does one have the chance to see the same man die twice?
I wish I was there to witness it.
I'm going to enjoy it even more than I did watching his friend dangling from a rope. All things considered, Stefan, this will have been a most successful trip, especially if...
It's all been taken care of, Mr. President, said Ivanitsky. I arranged yesterday for the income from the Yeltsin and Chernopov oil and uranium contracts to be diverted to your Zurich account. That is, unless Alexei countermands my orders when he returns.
If he doesn't return, he won't be able to, will he?
Zarimsky put the phone down, switched off the light, and fell asleep again within moments. At 5 o'clock that morning, Connor was lying motionless on his bed, fully dressed. He was going over his escape route when the wake-up call came through at 6. He rose, pulled back a corner of the curtain, and checked that they were still there. They were. Two white BMWs parked on the far side of the street, as they had been since midnight the previous evening. By now, their occupants would be drowsy. He knew they changed shifts at 8, so he planned to leave 10 minutes before the hour. He spent the next 30 minutes carrying out some light stretching exercises to get rid of his stiffness, then stripped off his clothes. He allowed the cold jets of the shower to needle his body for some time before he turned it off and grabbed a towel. Then he dressed in a blue shirt, a pair of jeans, a thick sweater, a blue tie, black socks, and a pair of black Nikes with the logo painted out. He went into the small kitchenette, poured himself a glass of grapefruit juice, and filled a bowl with cornflakes and milk. He always ate the same meal on the day of an operation. He liked routine. It helped him believe everything else would run smoothly. As he ate, he read over the 7 pages of notes he had made following his meeting with Pug, and once again minutely studied an architect's plan of the stadium. He measured the girder with a ruler and estimated that it was 42 feet to the trapdoor. He mustn't look down. He felt the calm come over him that a finely tuned athlete experiences when called to the starting line. He checked his watch and returned to the bedroom. They had to be at the intersection of 21st Street and DuPont Circle just as the traffic was building up. He waited a few more minutes, then put $300 bills, a quarter, and a 30-minute audio cassette in the back pocket of his jeans. He then left the anonymous apartment for the last time. His account had already been settled. Chapter 30. Zarimsky sat alone in the embassy dining room reading the Washington Post as a butler served him breakfast. He smiled when he saw the banner headline, Return of the Cold War. As he sipped his coffee, he mused for a moment on what the Post might lead with the following morning. Attempt to assassinate Russian president fails. Former CIA agent gunned down in embassy grounds? He smiled again and turned to the editorial, which confirmed that Lawrence's nuclear, biological, chemical, and conventional arms reduction bill was now considered by all the leading commentators to be dead in the water. Another useful expression he had picked up on his trip. At a few minutes past 7, he rang the silver bell by his side and asked the butler to fetch the ambassador and the first secretary. The butler hurried away. Zarimsky knew both men were already standing anxiously outside the door. The ambassador and the first secretary thought they should wait for a minute or two before joining the president. They were still uncertain if he was pleased to have been woken at 4 in the morning, but as neither of them had yet been fired, they assumed that they must have made the right decision.
"Good morning, Mr. President,"
said Piotrowski as he entered the dining room. Zarimsky nodded, folded the paper, and placed it on the table in front of him. "Has Romanov arrived yet?" he asked.
"Yes, Mr. President," said the first secretary. "He has been in the kitchen since 6 o'clock this morning, personally checking the food that's being delivered for tonight's banquet."
"Good. Ask him to join us in your study, Mr. Ambassador. I will be along shortly."
"Yes, sir,"
said Piotrowski, retreating backwards out of the room. Zarimsky wiped his mouth with a napkin. He decided to keep the three of them waiting for a few more minutes. That would make them even more nervous. He returned to the Washington Post, smiling as he read the editorial's conclusion for a second time. "Zarimsky is the natural successor to Stalin and Brezhnev, rather than Gorbachev or Yeltsin." He had no quarrel with that. In fact, he hoped that before the day was out, he would have reinforced that image. He rose from his chair and strolled out of the room. As he walked down the corridor towards the ambassador's study, a young man coming from the opposite direction stopped in his tracks, rushed over to the door, and opened it for him. A grandfather clock chimed as he entered the room. He instinctively checked his watch. It was exactly 7:45. At 8:10, Connor appeared at the entrance of the apartment building and walked slowly across the street to the first of the two BMWs. He climbed in beside a driver who looked a little surprised to see him so early. He had been told that Fitzgerald wasn't expected at the embassy until 4 o'clock that afternoon.
"I need to go downtown to pick up a couple of things," said Connor.
The man in the back nodded, so the driver put the car into first and joined the traffic on Wisconsin Avenue. The second car followed closely behind them as they turned left into P Street, which was thickly congested as a result of the construction work that plagued Georgetown. As each day passed, Connor had noticed that his minders had become more and more relaxed. At roughly the same time every morning, he had jumped out of the BMW at the corner of 21st Street and DuPont Circle, bought a copy of the Post from a news vendor, and returned to the car. Yesterday, the man in the back seat hadn't even bothered to accompany him. They crossed 23rd Street, and Connor could see DuPont Circle in the distance. The cars were now bumper to bumper and had almost ground to a halt. On the other side of the street, the traffic heading west was moving far more smoothly. He would need to judge exactly when to make his move. Connor knew that the lights on P Street approaching the circle changed every 30 seconds, and on average, 12 cars managed to get across during that time. The most he'd counted during the week was 16. When the light turned red, Connor counted 17 cars ahead of them. He didn't move a muscle. The light switched to green and the driver changed into first gear, but the traffic was so heavy that it was some time before he was able to edge forward. Only 8 cars crawled through the light. He had 30 seconds. He turned and smiled at his minder in the back and pointed to the news vendor. The man nodded. Connor stepped out onto the sidewalk and started walking slowly towards the old man wearing a fluorescent orange vest. He didn't once look back, so he had no idea if anyone from the second car was following him. He concentrated on the traffic moving in the opposite direction on the other side of the street, trying to estimate how long the line of cars would be when the light turned red again. When he reached the news vendor, he already had a quarter in his hand. He gave it to the old man, who handed him a copy of the Post. As he turned and began to walk back towards the first BMW, the light turned red, and the traffic came to a halt. Connor spotted the vehicle he needed. He suddenly switched direction and started sprinting, darting in and out of the stationary traffic on the westbound side of the street, until he reached an empty taxi 6 cars away from the lights. The two men in the second BMW leaped out of the car and began running after him, just as the light at DuPont Circle turned green. Connor pulled open the door and threw himself into the back of the taxi. "Straight ahead," he shouted. "You get $100 if you beat that light." The driver pressed the palm of his hand onto his horn and kept it there as he ran the red light. The two white BMWs executed screeching U-turns, but the lights had already changed, and their path was blocked by three stationary cars. So far, everything had gone to plan. The taxi swung left onto 23rd Street, and Connor instructed the driver to pull over. When the car had come to a halt, he passed him a $100 bill and said, "I want you to drive straight to Dulles Airport. If you spot a white BMW coming up behind you, don't let it overtake you. When you get to the airport, stop for 30 seconds outside departures, then drive slowly back into town."
"Okay, man, anything you say,"
said the driver, pocketing the $100 bill. Connor slipped out of the cab, darted across 23rd Street, and flagged down another cab heading in the opposite direction. He slammed the door shut as the two BMWs swept past him in pursuit of the first taxi.
"And where would you like to go this fine morning?"
"Cook Stadium.
I hope you got a ticket, man. Otherwise, I'll be bringing you straight back."
The three men stood as Zarimsky entered the room. He waved them down as if they were a large crowd and took the chair behind the ambassador's desk. He was surprised to see a rifle where the blotter would normally be, but he ignored it and turned to Alexei Romanov, who was looking rather pleased with himself.
"I have some sad news for you, Alexei," said the president.
Romanov's expression turned to apprehension and then to anxiety during the long silence Zarimsky allowed to follow.
"I received a call earlier this morning from your cousin Stefan. It appears that your father suffered a heart attack during the night and died on the way to hospital."
Romanov bowed his head. The ambassador and first secretary glanced towards the president to see how they should react. Zarimsky rose, walked slowly over to Romanov, and placed a consoling hand on his shoulder. The ambassador and first secretary looked suitably grief-stricken.
"I shall mourn him," said Zarimsky. "He was a great man."
The two diplomats nodded their agreement as Romanov inclined his head to acknowledge the president's kind words.
"Now his mantle has passed on to you, Alexei, a most worthy successor."
The ambassador and the chief secretary continued to nod.
"And soon," Zarimsky said, "you will be given an opportunity to demonstrate your authority in a way that will leave no one in Russia in any doubt who is the new Tsar."
Romanov raised his head and smiled, his brief period of mourning over.
"That is," added Zarimsky, "assuming nothing goes wrong this evening."
"Nothing can go wrong," said Romanov emphatically.
"I spoke to Fitzgerald just after midnight. He's agreed to my plan. He will report to the embassy at 4 o'clock this afternoon while you are at the football game with Lawrence."
"Why so early?"
asked Zarimsky. "We need everyone to think he's simply another member of the catering team so that when he slips out of the kitchen 6 hours later, nobody will give it a second thought. He will remain in the kitchen under my supervision until a few minutes before you rise to make your farewell speech."
"Excellent," said Zarimsky. "And then what happens?"
"I will accompany him to this room, where he will collect the rifle. He will then take the private elevator to the gallery that overlooks the ballroom."
Zarimsky nodded.
"Once he is there, he will position himself behind the great statue of Lenin, where he will remain until you reach that section of your speech where you thank the American people for their hospitality and the warm welcome you have received everywhere, etc., etc., and particularly from President Lawrence. At that point, I have arranged for prolonged applause. Throughout it, you must remain absolutely still."
"Why?" demanded Zarimsky.
"Because Fitzgerald won't squeeze the trigger if he thinks you're likely to make a sudden movement."
"I understand."
"Once he has fired, he will climb out onto the ledge by the cedar tree in the back garden. He made us repeat the whole exercise several times yesterday afternoon, but this evening he will discover there is a small difference."
"And what is that?" asked Zarimsky.
"Waiting under the tree will be 6 of my personal bodyguards," said Romanov. "They will have gunned him down long before his feet touch the ground."
Zarimsky was silent for a moment before saying,
"But surely your plan has a minor flaw."
Romanov looked puzzled.
How am I expected to survive a shot from a marksman of Fitzgerald's reputation from such close range?
Romanov rose from his chair and picked up the rifle. He removed a small piece of metal and handed it to the president.
What is this?
The firing pin, Romanov replied.
Chapter 31. The two white BMWs sped west on Route 66, pursuing an empty taxi that exceeded the speed limit all the way to Dulles Airport. A second cab was traveling east at a more leisurely pace towards Cook Stadium in Maryland. Connor thought again about his decision to choose the stadium with all its risks rather than the embassy. He had been allowed in and out of that building far too easily. No one was that lax about security, especially when their president was in town. When Connor was dropped at the stadium, he knew exactly where to go. He walked up the wide gravel path towards the north entrance and the two long lines of people who hung around before every home game in the hope of a day's work. Some of them just needed the cash, while others, Puggett explained, were such fanatical Skins fans that they would resort to anything, including bribery, to get into the stadium.
Bribery? Connor had asked innocently. Oh, yes. Someone has to serve in the executive suites, said Pug with a wink, and they end up with the best view of the game.
Fascinating material for my article, Connor had assured him. The first queue was for those who wanted to work outside the stadium, organizing the parking for the 23,000 cars and buses, or selling programs, cushions, and souvenirs to the 78,000 fans. The other was for those who hoped to work inside the stadium. Connor joined that queue, mostly made up of the young, the unemployed, and what Pug had described as the early retirement junkies who simply enjoyed the regular outing. Pug had even described how this group dressed, so that no one would mistake them for the unemployed. On this particular day, a handful of Secret Service men were eyeing the hopeful applicants. Connor kept reading the Washington Post as the line moved slowly forward. Most of the front page was devoted to Zarimsky's speech to the joint session of Congress. The reaction from the members was universally hostile. When he turned to the editorial, he suspected Zarimsky would be pleased with it. He turned to the metro section, and a wry smile crossed his face as he read of the premature death of a distinguished academic from his hometown.
"Hi," said a voice.
Connor glanced round at a smartly dressed young man who had joined the queue behind him.
"Hi," he responded briefly before returning to his paper. He didn't want to get involved in an unnecessary conversation with someone who might later be called as a witness.
"My name's Brad,"
the young man announced, thrusting out his right hand. Connor shook it, but said nothing.
"I'm hoping to get a job on one of the lighting towers," he added. "How about you?"
"Why the lighting towers?" asked Connor, avoiding his question.
"Because that's where the Secret Service's special agent in charge will be stationed, and I want to find out what the job's really like."
"Why?" asked Connor, folding up his paper. This was clearly not a conversation he could easily cut short.
"I'm thinking about joining them when I leave college. I've already taken the graduate training course, but I want to see them working at close quarters. An agent told me the one job nobody wants is taking meals up to the guys on the lighting platforms behind the end zones. All those steps scare them off."
All 172 of them, thought Connor, who had dismissed the idea of the lighting towers early on, not because of the steps, but because there was no escape route. Brad started to tell him his life story. By the time Connor reached the front of the queue, he knew which school the boy had been to, that he was now a senior at Georgetown studying criminology. That made him think of Maggie. And why, he still couldn't decide whether to join the Secret Service or be a lawyer.
"Next," said a voice.
Connor turned round to the man seated behind a trestle table.
"What have you got left?"
Connor asked.
"Not much,"
said the man, looking down at the list covered with ticks.
"Anything in catering?" asked Connor.
Like Brad, he knew exactly where he wanted to be.
"Washing dishes or serving meals to employees around the stadium is all I got left."
"That'll be just fine."
"Name?"
"Dave Krinkle," said Connor.
"ID?"
Connor handed over a driver's license. The man filled in a security pass, and a photographer stepped forward and took a Polaroid of Connor, which seconds later was laminated onto the pass.
Okay, Dave, the man said, handing it over. This pass will get you everywhere inside the stadium except the high security area, which includes the executive suites, the club boxes, and the VIP section. You won't need to go there anyway. Connor nodded and clipped the pass onto his sweater. Report to room 47, directly below Block H. Connor moved off to the left. He knew exactly where room 47 was. Next. It took him a lot longer to get through the three security checks, including the magnetometer, than it had the previous day, as they were now manned by Secret Service personnel rather than the usual rent-a-cops. Once Connor was inside the stadium, he ambled slowly along the inner walkway past the museum and under a red banner declaring Hail Victory, until he came to a stairway with an arrow pointing down to room 47, private catering. Inside the small room at the foot of the stairs, he found a dozen men lounging around. They all looked as if they were familiar with the routine. He recognized one or two had been standing in the line in front of him. No one else in the room looked as if they didn't need the money. He took a seat in a corner and returned to the post, rereading a preview of the afternoon's game. Tony Kornheiser thought it would be nothing less than a miracle if the Redskins beat the Packers, the finest team in the country. In fact, he was predicting a 20-point margin. Connor was hoping for a totally different outcome.
Okay, said a voice. Pay attention.
Connor looked up to see a huge man wearing a chef's uniform standing in front of them. He was about 50 with an enormous double chin and must have weighed over 250 pounds.
I'm the catering manager, he said, and as you can see, I represent the glamour end of the business.
One or two of the old hands laughed politely.
I can offer you two choices. You can either wash dishes or you serve stadium employees and security guys stationed around the stadium. Any volunteers for the dishes?
Most of the men in the room put their hands up. Dishwashing, Puckett explained, was always popular because not only did the washers get the full rate of $10 an hour, but for some of them, the leftovers from the executive boxes were the best meal they had all week.
Good,
he said, picking out five of them and writing down their names. When he had completed the list, he said,
Now, waiting. You can either serve the senior staff or the security personnel. Senior staff,
he said, looking up from his clipboard. Almost all the remaining hands shot up. Again, the catering manager wrote down five names. When he'd finished, he tapped his clipboard.
Okay, he said. Everyone on the list can now report to work.
The old pros rose from their seats and shuffled past him through a door that Connor knew led to the kitchens. Only he and Brad were still in the room.
I got two jobs left in security, said the catering manager. One great, one lousy. Which one of you is going to get lucky?
He looked hopefully at Connor, who nodded and placed a hand in his back pocket. The catering manager walked up to him, not even glancing at Brad, and said,
I have a feeling you'd prefer the comfort of the Jumbotron.
Right first time, said Connor, slipping him a $100 bill.
Just as I thought,
said the catering manager, returning his smile.
Connor said nothing, as the fat man pocketed the cash exactly as Pug had predicted he would. That man had been worth every cent of his fee.
I should never have invited him in the first place,
Tom Lawrence growled as he boarded Marine One to take him from the White House to the Redskins Stadium.
And I have a feeling that our problems aren't over yet, said Andy Lloyd, strapping himself into his seat.
Why, what else can go wrong?
Asked Lawrence, as the helicopter blades slowly began to rotate.
There are still two public events before Zarymsky returns to Russia, and my bet is that Fitzgerald will be waiting for us at one of them.
This evening shouldn't be a problem, said Lawrence. Ambassador Piotrowski has told the Secret Service on countless occasions that his people are quite capable of protecting their own president. In any case, who would take that sort of risk with so much security around?
The normal rules don't apply to Fitzgerald, said Lloyd. He doesn't work by the book. The president glanced down at the Russian embassy.
It would be hard enough just getting into that building, he said, without having to worry about how you'd get out of it.
Fitzgerald wouldn't have the same trouble this afternoon in a stadium holding nearly 80,000 spectators, replied Lloyd.
That's the one place you would find it easy to slip in and out of.
Don't forget, Andy, there's only a 13-minute window when any problem could arise. Even then, everybody in the stadium will have passed through the magnetometers, so there's no way anyone could get a penknife in, let alone a gun.
You think Fitzgerald doesn't know that? Said Lloyd, as the helicopter swung east. It's not too late to cancel that part of the program.
No, said Lawrence firmly. If Clinton could stand in the middle of the Olympic Stadium in Atlanta for the opening ceremony, I can do the same in Washington for a football game. Damn it, Andy, we live in a democracy, and I'm not going to allow our lives to be dictated to in that way. And don't forget that I'll be out there taking exactly the same risk as Zarimsky.
I accept that, sir, said Lloyd. But if Zarimsky were to be assassinated, no one would praise you for standing by his side. Least of all, Helen Dexter. She'd be the first to point out...
Who do you think will win this afternoon, Andy?
Asked the president.
Lloyd smiled at a ploy his boss often fell back on if he didn't wish to continue discussing an unpalatable subject.
I don't know, sir, he replied. But until I saw how many of my staff were trying to cram themselves into the advance cars this morning... I had no idea we had so many Skins fans working at the White House.
Some of them might just have been Packers fans, said Lawrence.
He opened the file on his lap and began to study the short profiles of the guests he would be meeting at the stadium.
Okay, pay attention, said the catering manager.
Connor gave the impression of listening intently.
The first thing you do is collect a white coat and a Redskins cap to show you're on the staff. Then you take the elevator to the 7th level and wait for me to put the food in the service elevator. The Secret Service agents have a snack at 10 and lunch, Coke, sandwiches, whatever else they want, at the start of the game. You press the button on the left-hand side, he continued as if he was addressing a 10-year-old, and it should be with you in about a minute.
Connor could have told him that it took exactly 47 seconds for the service elevator to travel from the basement to the 7th level. But as there were 2 other levels, the 2nd, club seats, and the 5th, executive suites, which also had access to the service lift, he might have to wait until their orders were completed before the elevator reached him, in which case it could take as long as 3 minutes.
Once your order arrives, you take the tray to the officers stationed inside the Jumbotron at the eastern end of the ground. You'll find a door marked private down the walkway to your left.
37 paces, Connor recalled.
Here's the key. You go through it and down an enclosed walkway until you reach the back entrance of the Jumbotron.
70 yards, thought Connor. In his footballing days, he could have covered that distance in around 7 seconds. While the manager continued to tell him things he already knew, Connor studied the service elevator. It was 2'3" by 2'7", and inside were clearly printed the words, Maximum weight permitted, 150 pounds. Connor weighed 210 pounds, so he hoped the designer had allowed a bit of leeway. There were 2 other problems. He wouldn't be able to test it out, and there was nothing he could do to prevent it from being stopped at the 5th or 2nd floors once he was on his way down.
When you reach the door at the back of the Jumbotron, the catering manager was saying, you knock, and the agent on duty will unbolt it and let you in. Once you've handed him the tray, you can go to the back of the stadium and watch the 1st quarter. At the break, you go and get the tray and take it to the service elevator. You press the green button, and it will go back down to the basement. Then you can watch the rest of the game. Did you understand all that, Dave?
Connor was tempted to say, no, sir, would you be kind enough to run through it once again, but a little more slowly.
Yes, sir. Any questions?
No, sir.
Okay. If the officer treats you good, I'll send him up a steak after full time. When he's finished that, report to me and collect your pay.
$50, he winked. Pug had explained that serious fans didn't bother to pick up their wages if they wanted to be offered the job again.
Remember, he had said, when the manager mentions the word pay, just wink.
Connor had no intention of collecting the $50, or of ever returning to the stadium. He winked.
Chapter 32 Why is Lawrence traveling to the game by helicopter when I'm stuck in the back of this car?
Zerimsky asked as his 9 limousine motorcade swept out of the embassy gates.
He has to make sure he's there before you, said Titov. He wants to be introduced to all the guests so that by the time you arrive he can give the impression he's known them all his life.
What a way to run a country, said Zerimsky. Not that this afternoon is important.
He was silent for a moment.
Do you know, I've even seen the rifle Fitzgerald plans to kill me with,
he said eventually. Titov looked surprised.
He's using the same model the CIA planted on him in St. Petersburg, but with a refinement.
He put a hand in his jacket pocket.
What do you think this is?
He asked, holding up what looked like a bent nail.
Titov shook his head. I've no idea.
It's the firing pin of a Remington 700, Zerimsky replied. So we can even allow him to pull the trigger before the bodyguards begin to pump bullets into him.
He studied it closely.
I think I'll have it mounted and keep it on my desk in the Kremlin.
He dropped it back in his pocket.
Has the speech I meant to be giving tonight been released to the press?
Yes, Mr. President, replied Titov.
It's full of the usual platitudes. You can be confident that not a word of it will ever be printed.
And what about my spontaneous reaction after Fitzgerald has been killed?
I have it here, Mr. President.
Good. Give me a taste of it, said Zerimsky, leaning back in his seat.
Titov removed a file from the case by his side and began reading from a handwritten script.
On the day of my election, President Lawrence telephoned me at the Kremlin and gave me a personal invitation to visit his country. I accepted that offer in good faith. What happens when I take it up? My outstretched hand is met not with an olive branch, but with a rifle pointing directly at me. And where? In my own embassy. And who pulled the trigger? An officer of the CIA. Had it not been for my good fortune, a former officer, interrupted Zerimsky.
I thought it prudent, said Titov, looking up from his notes, for you to appear to make the occasional error, even to repeat yourself. That way no one will suggest you always knew what was going on. In America they want to believe that everything is a conspiracy.
I shall be only too happy to fuel the paranoia, said Zerimsky. Long after Lawrence has been removed, I expect Americans will be writing copious volumes about how I was responsible for the complete breakdown in relations between the two countries. Lawrence's administration will end up as nothing more than a footnote in the history of the resurgence of the Russian Empire under my presidency.
He beamed at Titov.
And after I have achieved that, there will be no more talk of elections, because I shall remain in power until the day I die.
Connor checked his watch. It was 9:56. He pressed the button beside the service elevator and immediately heard the whir of an engine as it began its slow journey up to the 7th level. There were still 34 minutes before the stadium would be open to the public, although Connor knew it would take some time for the crowd to pass through the 30 magnetometers and the personal security checks. But he was keeping to a far stricter timetable than anyone else in the stadium. 47 seconds later, he removed the tray and pressed the button to let the staff in the basement know he had received it. He walked quickly along the 7th-floor concourse, past a concession stand, and up to the door marked private. He balanced the tray on one hand, turned the key in the lock with the other, and slipped inside. Then he switched on the lights and strode down the covered walkway at the back of the Jumbotron. He checked his watch again. 83 seconds. Too long. But as the final run would be without a tray, it should be possible to complete the whole exercise from roof to basement in under 2 minutes. If it all went to plan, he would be out of the stadium and on his way to the airport before they had time to set up any roadblocks. Connor balanced the tray in one hand and knocked on the door with the other. A few seconds later, it was opened by a tall, heavily built man who stood silhouetted in an oblong of light.
"I've brought you a snack," said Connor with a warm smile.
"Great," said the sharpshooter. "Why don't you come in and join me?"
He removed a pastrami sandwich from the tray
and Connor followed him along a thin, galvanized steel platform behind a vast screen made up of 786 televisions. The Secret Service man sat down and dug his teeth into the sandwich. Connor tried not to let him see how closely he was studying his rifle. The Jumbotron was on three floors, one above the platform and one below. Connor put the tray down beside the officer who was sitting in the middle of the flight of stairs that led to the lower ramp. He took more interest in his can of Diet Coke than in Connor's roaming eyes.
"By the way," he said between swigs, "I'm Arnie Cooper."
"Dave Crinkle," Connor replied.
"So how much did you have to pay for the privilege of spending the afternoon with me?"
asked Arnie with a grin. Marine One landed at the heliport to the northeast of the stadium, and a limousine purred up even before the copter's steps had touched the ground. Lawrence and Lloyd emerged a moment later, and the president turned to wave to the large gathering of well-wishers before climbing into the back of the waiting car. They covered the quarter mile to the stadium in under a minute, passing through every security check without hindrance. John Kent Cook, the owner of the Redskins, was waiting at the stadium's entrance to greet them.
"This is a great honor, sir," he said, as Lawrence stepped out of the limousine. "It's good to meet you, John," replied the president, shaking the slim, gray-haired man by the hand.
Cook guided his guest towards a private lift.
"Do you really believe the Skins can win, John?" Lawrence asked with a grin. "Now that's the sort of loaded question I might have expected from a politician, Mr. President," Cook replied as they stepped into the lift. "Everyone knows you're the Packers' number one fan, but I'm bound to say the answer to your question is, yes, sir, fight for old D.C., the Skins will win."
"The Washington Post doesn't agree with you," said the president as the doors opened at the press level.
"I'm sure you're the last person to believe everything you read in the Post, Mr. President," said Cook.
Both men laughed as he led Lawrence into his box, a large, comfortable room positioned above the 50-yard line with a perfect view of the whole field.
"Mr. President, I'd like to introduce you to one or two of the folks who have made the Redskins the greatest football team in America. Let me start with my wife, Rita."
"Good to meet you, Rita," Lawrence said, shaking her by the hand. "And congratulations on your triumph at the National Symphony Ball. I'm told they raised a record amount under your chairmanship."
Mrs. Cook beamed with pride. Lawrence was able to recall an appropriate fact or anecdote about every person he was introduced to, including the little old man wearing a Redskins blazer who couldn't possibly have been a former player.
"This is Pug Washer," said John Kent Cook, placing a hand on the old man's shoulder. "Now he is the only man in history to make the Redskins Hall of Fame without playing a single game for the team," said the president.
A huge smile appeared on Pug's face.
"And I'm also told that you know more about the history of the team than any living person."
Pug promised himself he would never vote Republican again.
"So tell me, Pug, in Packers versus Skins games, what were Vince Lombardi's regular season points when he was coaching the Packers compared to his year with the Skins?"
"Packers 459, Skins 435, said Pug with a rueful smile.
"Just as I thought, he should never have left the Packers in the first place," said the president, slapping Pug on the back.
"You know, Mr. President," said Cook, "I've never been able to come up with a question about the Redskins that Pug wasn't able to answer."
"Has anyone ever stumped you, Pug?"
asked the president, turning to the walking encyclopedia again.
"They try all the time, Mr. President," Pug replied. "Why, only yesterday a man..."
Before Pug could complete his sentence, Andy Lloyd touched Lawrence's elbow. "I'm sorry to interrupt you, sir, but we've just been informed that President Zarimsky is only 5 minutes away from the stadium. You and Mr. Cook should make your way to the northeast entrance now so that you'll be in time to welcome him."
"Yes, of course," said Lawrence. He turned to Pug and said, "Let's continue our conversation just as soon as I get back."
Pug nodded as the president and his entourage left the room to go and greet Zarimsky.
"It's a bit cramped in here," Connor shouted above the noise of the large ventilation fan in the ceiling.
"Sure is,"
said Arnie, finishing off his Diet Coke. "But I guess it goes with a job."
"Are you expecting any trouble today?"
"Nope, not really,"
Of course, we'll all be on full alert the moment the two presidents walk out onto the field, but that only lasts for about 8 minutes. Although if Special Agent Braithwaite had his way, neither of them would be allowed out of the owner's box until it was time for him to go home.
Connor nodded and asked several more innocuous questions, listening carefully to Arnie's Brooklyn accent and concentrating especially on any expressions he used regularly. As Arnie dug his teeth into a slice of chocolate cake, Connor looked through a gap in the rotating advertising boards. Most of the Secret Service officers in the stadium were also taking a snack break. He focused on the lighting tower behind the western end zone. Brad was up there, listening intently to an officer who was pointing towards the owner's box. Just the sort of young man the service needed to recruit, thought Connor. He turned back to Arnie.
"I'll see you again at the start of the game. A plate of sandwiches, another slice of cake, and some more Coke suit you?" "Yep, sounds great, but go easy on the cake. I don't mind my wife telling me I've put on a few pounds, but lately the SAIC has begun to comment on it."
A siren sounded to let all the staff in the stadium know it was 10:30 and the gates were about to be opened. The fans began to flood into the stands, most of them heading straight for their usual seats. Connor gathered up the empty Coke can and the plastic container and placed them on the tray.
"I'll be back with your lunch when the game kicks off," he said. "Yep," replied Arnie, his binoculars now focused on the crowd below. "But don't come in until after the two presidents are back in the owner's box. No one else is allowed in the Jumbotron while they're out on the field."
"Okay, I understand," said Connor, taking a last look at Arnie's rifle. As he turned to go, he heard a voice coming over a two-way radio.
"Hercules 3.
Arnie unclipped the radio from the back of his belt, pressed a button, and said,
"Hercules 3, go ahead."
Connor hesitated by the door.
"Nothing to report, sir. I was just about to run an eye over the west stand."
"Fine. Report in if you see anything suspicious."
"Will do,"
said Arnie, and clipped the receiver back onto his belt. Connor quietly stepped out onto the covered walkway, closed the door behind him, and placed the empty Coke can on the step. He checked his watch, then walked quickly down the covered walkway, unlocked the door, and turned off the lights. The concourse was swarming with fans heading for their seats. When he reached the lift shaft, he checked his watch again. 54 seconds. On the final run, it would have to take less than 35. He pressed the button. 47 seconds later, the service elevator reappeared. Obviously, no one on the second or fifth levels had been calling for it. He placed the tray inside and pressed the button once again. It immediately began its slow journey down to the basement. No one gave Connor, dressed in a long white catering coat and a Redskins cap, a second glance as he strolled casually past the concession stand towards the door marked private. He slipped inside and locked the door behind him. In the darkness, he walked noiselessly back along the narrow walkway until he was a few yards from the entrance to the Jumbotron. He stood looking down at the vast steel girder that held the massive screen in place. Connor gripped the handrail for a moment, then fell to his knees. He leaned forward, grabbed the girder with both hands, and eased himself off the walkway. He stared fixedly at the screen, which, according to the architect's plans, was 42 feet in front of him. It looked more like a mile. He could see a small handle, but he still had no idea if the emergency trapdoor that had been clearly marked on the engineer's plans really existed. He began to crawl slowly along the girder, inch by inch, never once looking down at the 170-foot drop below him. It felt like 2 miles. When he finally reached the end of the girder, he dropped his legs over the sides and gripped tightly as if he was on horseback. The screen switched from a replay of a touchdown in the Skins' previous game to an advertisement for Modell's Sporting Goods Store. Connor took a deep breath, gripped the handle, and pulled. The trapdoor slid back, revealing the promised 22-and-a-half-inch square hole. Connor slowly hauled himself inside and slid the door back in place. Pressed in on all sides by steel, he began to wish that he had added a thick pair of gloves to his clothing. It was like being inside a refrigerator. Nevertheless, as each minute passed, he became more confident that should it prove necessary to fall back on his contingency plan,
no one would ever discover where he was hiding. He lay suspended inside the hollow steel girder, 170 feet above the ground, for over an hour and a half, barely able to turn his wrist to check the time. But then, in Vietnam, he'd once spent 10 days solitary confinement, standing upright in a bamboo cage with water up to his chin, something he suspected Arnie had never experienced. Chapter 33. Zarimsky shook hands warmly with everyone he was introduced to, and even laughed at John Kent Cook's jokes. He remembered the names of all the guests and answered every question that was put to him with a smile. "What the Americans call a charm offensive," Titov had told him. It would only add to the horror of what he had planned for them that evening. He could already hear the guests telling the press. He couldn't have been more relaxed and at ease, especially with the president, whom he kept referring to as my dear and close friend Tom. Lawrence, the guests would recall, did not show quite the same degree of warmth and was slightly frosty towards his Russian visitor. After the introductions had been completed, John Kent Cook banged on a table with a spoon. "I'm sorry to interrupt such a pleasant occasion," he began, "but time is marching on, and this is probably going to be the only opportunity I have in my life to brief two presidents at once." A little laughter broke out. "So, here goes." He put on a pair of glasses and began reading from a sheet of paper handed to him by his public affairs assistant. "At 11:20, I will accompany both presidents to the south entrance of the stadium, and at 11:36, I will lead them out onto the field." He looked up. "I have arranged for the welcome to be deafening," he said with a smile. Rita laughed, just a little too loudly. "When we reach the center of the field, I will introduce the presidents to the two team captains, and they, in turn, will introduce them to their co-captains and the coaches. Then the presidents will be introduced to the match officials. At 11:40, everyone will turn and face the west stand, where the Redskins band will play the Russian national anthem, followed after a short pause by the Star-Spangled Banner. At precisely 11:48, our honored guest, President Zarimsky, will flip a silver dollar. I shall then accompany both gentlemen off the field and bring them back here, where I hope everyone will enjoy watching the Redskins defeat the Packers." Both presidents laughed. Cook looked up at his guests, smiling with relief that the first part of his ordeal was over, and asked, "Any questions?"
"Yes, John, I have a question," said Zarimsky. "You didn't explain why I have to flip the coin."
"So that the captain who correctly guesses whether it's heads or tails can choose which team kicks off."
"What an amusing idea," said Zarimsky.
As the minutes slipped by, Connor checked his watch more and more frequently. He didn't want to be inside the Jumbotron for any longer than necessary, but he needed time to familiarize himself with a rifle he hadn't used for some years. He checked his watch again. 11:10. He'd wait for another 7 minutes. However impatient you become, never go early. It only adds to the risk. 11:12. He thought about Chris Jackson and the sacrifice he had made just to give him this one chance. 11:14. He thought about Joan and the cruel and unnecessary death Guttenberg had ordered for no reason other than that she had been his secretary. 11:15. He thought about Maggie and Tara. If he managed to pull this off, it might just give them a chance to live in peace. Either way, he doubted if he would ever see them again. 11:17. Connor slid open the trapdoor and eased himself slowly out of the confined space. He gathered his strength for a moment before swinging his legs over the girder and gripping it firmly with his thighs. Again, he didn't look down as he began the slow 42-foot crawl back to the walkway. Once he had reached the safety of the ledge, he pulled himself up onto the walkway. He held onto the rail for a few moments, steadied himself, and began a short series of stretching exercises. 11:27. He breathed deeply as he went over his plan for the final time, then walked quickly towards the Jumbotron, pausing only to pick up the empty Coke can he had left on the step. He banged loudly on the door. Without waiting for a response, he opened it
marched in and shouted above the noise of the ventilation unit. "It's only me!" Arnie peered down from the ledge above, his right hand moving towards the trigger of his Armalite.
"Beat it," he said. "I told you not to come back till the presidents were off the field. You're lucky I didn't put a bullet through you."
"Sorry," said Connor. "It's just that I noticed how hot it gets in here, so I brought you another Coke." He passed the empty can up, and Arnie bent down to take it with his free hand. As his fingers touched the rim of the can, Connor let go of it, grabbed him by the wrist, and with all the strength he could muster, pulled him down from the ledge. Arnie let out a terrible scream as he came crashing over, landing headfirst on the galvanized walkway, his rifle skidding away across it. Connor swung round and leapt on his adversary before he had a chance to get up. As Arnie raised his head, Connor landed a straight left to the chin that stunned him for a moment, then grabbed for the pair of handcuffs hanging from his belt. He only just caught sight of the knee flying towards his crotch, but deftly moved to his left and managed to avoid its full impact. As Arnie tried to rise to his feet, Connor landed another punch, this time full on the nose. Connor heard the break, and as blood began to flow down his face, Arnie's legs buckled, and he sank to the ground. Connor sprang on him again, and as Arnie tried to get up, he delivered a blow to his right shoulder that caused him to go into spasms. This time, when he collapsed onto the walkway, he finally lay still.